As we continue our study of the book of Exodus, we are getting into the most important events of Israel's history. This is the backdrop for everything that Jesus did. It is the starting point of the whole nation of Israel. I mean, they would trace their heritage to Abraham, of course, but they were a single family. The beginning of the nation of Israel is these events in Exodus. So God has done a good part of his rescue of Israel and the defeat of Egypt, although the final thing remains ahead of us. He has established the covenant meal. Every meal has a covenant and a sacrifice. So we have the lamb whose blood is shed and painted on the door, and we have the meal that God provides for his people. Picking up on the picture in the 23rd Psalm, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. So that is the Passover meal. It's a covenant meal. God gave to, as the host of that meal, gave clear instructions to the children of Israel in Exodus. And at the end of the chapter, that's the last thing that we talked about, he spelled out the restrictions. Who may participate in this meal? Well, Holy Communion is the covenant meal. The restrictions, the basic principles of the restrictions that apply to Passover also apply to Holy Communion. The idea that has developed in the Christian church in the last 75 years, it started before that, but became widespread in the last 75 years, that anyone can go to communion, has never been a part of the Christian tradition. But leave it to Americans to utterly forget any kind of history and only think that whatever they want is what God wishes and needs. Only our nation in modern times can, maybe the Japanese too, they're as bad as we are. It's just, we're not going to be restricted. People will say, they'll ask you about communion, say, well, you know, if you're not a part of our fellowship, then you need to find out about participating, but you can't do it right now. Well, who are you to tell me that I can't go to communion? No. Well, hello, I represent St. Mark's Lutheran Church, and we're responsible for who goes. That's why we're telling you. I don't say it like that, but I mean, when you're challenged, I mean, that's the answer to that challenge. Churches that, it's so bizarre to practice open communion. In effect, churches are saying, well, we don't know who you are, but we don't care. You can come in and go to communion. Maybe you're utterly unprepared to do that. Maybe you have no idea what you're doing, but it's not our responsibility. And people will say, well, communion is between me and the Lord. You know, okay, go home and sit down at your dining room table and have communion. Mm-hmm. See? But it's not between you and the Lord. That's why we're doing it here, together. But these, I think for our people we can understand that. But it's important for us to be able to articulate to people why we don't have open communion. So there are two things that militate against open communion. One is the responsibility of a congregation to make certain that anyone who comes to the Lord's table knows what he's doing. That's spelled out in these Passover restrictions too. So this is somebody who must be baptized. This is somebody who must understand what he's doing. Secondly, and that we haven't particularly talked about, is that communion is a function, a demonstration of fellowship. We are one. We all eat of the same loaf. We all drink of the same cup. If we don't have... here, a question. You want to sit in on class? Yes, okay, very good. Oh, okay.
My roommate want to go home by bus because we are now two.
Okay.
If we can go back safely.
Okay.
So thank you.
Okay.
You'll go
home
by bus.
Okay.
Bye.
Good night. Bye.
Good night.
Okay. Okay, because Holy Communion is a demonstration of oneness of faith, that requires that people be one in faith. Again, this fails to be understood because in our world, our religious nation here, fundamentalism is triumphant. And so people think, well, I'm a believer in Jesus, you're a believer in Jesus, that's it. That's all that's necessary. As long as you agree on the fundamentals, that's it. The apostles knew nothing about such an idea of fundamentalism. The apostles knew what Jesus had given them. The idea that there would be any other doctrine besides what Jesus gave them was absolutely out of the question. The Apostle Paul says, "Mark them which cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you have learned, and avoid them." There's only one apostolic doctrine, and the Savior told the disciples clearly, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. That is not difficult to understand. I had a discussion, it was a friendly discussion with somebody with a Pentecostal and evangelical background, and we were talking about making a decision to become a Christian. So I was explaining to him that if you're dead in sin and you become alive, what decision is involved? Well, you have to decide. I said, did Lazarus decide to rise from the dead? Answer, no. Well, he said, I don't agree. And I said, well, okay, you don't agree, but you have to have a reason for not agreeing. You know, what about this passage or talking about Genesis 3, what did Adam and Eve do? His answer, nothing. I said, exactly. You read the chapter exactly right. They didn't do anything. God recreated them, brought them back from death. They disobeyed God. They walked the way of death. They were hiding in the bushes. There was nothing they could do. God changed it. They did nothing. Well, I don't agree. Okay, but that's where we are today, and it is necessary for us to be faithful to God's word, that we have the same attitude toward what Jesus taught that Paul did, or Peter, or John. So, if there are questions, we'll take those about the Passover restrictions. Otherwise, we're ready to go on chapter 13. This exciting story continues. The Lord said to Moses, consecrate to me every firstborn male. Had the firstborn males been particularly important before this? Can you think of a firstborn male previous to this who figured prominently in the coming of the Savior? Yeah, and Cain was the firstborn, so he didn't count for much.
No.
Right?
Isaac was Sarah's firstborn.
But Isaac was not Moses, yeah. Was not Abraham's firstborn. And so he didn't count as a firstborn.
I'm going to say no to the question.
Yeah. No, no firstborn mattered before this. And I don't know that they're particularly going to matter after this, but now in this interim of 400 years from Israel during the time that they were in Egypt until now, God has formed a nation. And now God says to this nation of Israel, the firstborn belongs to me. And of course, who is ultimately a firstborn?
Jesus.
Jesus, right. So human ways before this, God makes clear that it isn't your birth order or who you are, that none of that matters. But now the firstborn is dedicated to the Lord. The first offspring of every womb among the Israelites belongs to me, whether man or animal. Yes?
You're talking about the firstborn, and I think of the firstborn as Christ being the sacrifice. When they were...
Well, what's the connection between firstborn and sacrifice? I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, that's kind of what I was trying to get to.
Oh, all right. Okay,
go ahead. Talking about always the first fruits of the crop and the first, of the animals, you know, for sacrifice was always the first and the best.
The best, especially, not the first, but the first fruits of the crop were... Well, that's kind of separate, really. I mean, the crop is ripening. The first thing belongs to the Lord. That's the same principle as here. Consecrate to me the firstborn. But it doesn't relate to Cain or to Isaac. You got Jacob. He was not the firstborn. Isaac was not the firstborn. Abel was not the firstborn. And of course, Abel was killed. And then the thirdborn becomes the one who carries it on, or maybe he's not even the thirdborn. We don't know that for sure. But he is the next one that's mentioned. God is saying, you as a nation and as a people must recognize that the very first thing that's born belongs to me. Everything belongs to me. But this one is mine, and you're going to have to deal with that. Now, this gets spelled out briefly here, but it gets talked about also in Numbers and again in Deuteronomy, where the exact details are spelled out. So let's go ahead and look at this. The Lord tells Moses, the firstborn belongs to me, men and animals. Then Moses said to the people, commemorate this day, the day you came out of Egypt. See, this is the after the Passover, the night of the Passover. Out of the land of slavery, because the Lord brought you out of it with a mighty hand. Eat nothing containing yeast. Today, in the month of Abib, you are leaving. When the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Hivites, and Jebusites, the land he swore to your forefathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Remember that phrase? Milk comes from animals who feed on that does not grow with irrigation. It just depends on the rain falling. And the fruit, the honey is the fruit. And again, that just, it's not dependent on irrigation in particular. It's a land that has the fruit in it and the grass grows and God, it's not like Egypt, a narrow land. Eat nothing containing yeast. Today in the month of Abib, you are leaving. When the Lord brings you into the... the land flowing with milk and honey, you are to observe this ceremony, Passover. The firstborn belongs to me. What had just happened to the firstborn?
Killed.
Yeah, the firstborn died unless they were protected by the blood of the lamb. So, for 7 days, eat bread made without yeast, and on the seventh day, hold a festival to the Lord. And actually, they began with a festival. We'll see further details. But the beginning festival here was already passed. It was the Passover meal. Eat unleavened bread during those 7 days. Nothing with yeast in it is to be seen among you, nor shall any yeast be seen anywhere within your borders. So it's to be completely dismissed. On that day, when you eat the meal, tell your son, I do this because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. This observance will be for you like a sign on your hand and a reminder on your forehead that the law of the Lord is to be on your lips. For the Lord brought you out of Egypt with his mighty hand. You must keep this ordinance at the appointed time, year after year. And having it on your hand, the Jews took that literally. I don't know that the Lord necessarily commanded, but certainly it was all right for them to decide that. They made little pouches of animal skin and put the law in them and tied them around their hands and on their forehead. Among most Jews, it was children who wore that, because later on in Deuteronomy, it talks about doing this for your children. But if you go to New York, for example, or if you went to Jerusalem, but there would be more in New York, there aren't very many Orthodox. There are way more Orthodox Jews in New York than there are in Jerusalem. Oh, by far. People in Jerusalem aren't religious at all. The religious parties in Israel are tiny minorities. They're only powerful because they hold the balance of power between the Labor Party and the Likud. And so they have more power than they normally would. It's a strange situation in Israel. All right. And so they wear these, and they write out a little bit of God's law. The God, when we hear law, don't think the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are part of the covenant that God made with his people. The law is the Torah, the instruction of God. It's all of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And it's anything that reflects the truth that Moses brings us in those verses. So they wrote out important verses like, I am who I am, or Hear, O Israel. That's probably the most popular one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And would put these, roll these up and put these in these little things made out of animal skin and wear them. So you can find phylacteries. Is what the term for them is in English, phylacteries. So, like I say, if you went to the Diamond District in New York, for example, you would see lots of Hasidic Jews. And yeah, with little ringlets, right. All right. Verse 11. After the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and gives it to you as he promised on oath to you and your forefathers, you are to give over to the Lord the first offspring of every womb. So after you get into the land, this is what you are to do. At all the firstborn males of your livestock belong to the Lord. Redeem with a lamb every firstborn donkey. Now see, every lamb, firstborn lamb, belongs to the Lord. It's to be sacrificed to the Lord. But if you sacrificed every firstborn donkey, you're not going to have many donkeys around. So you can buy back the donkey with the sacrifice of a lamb. And as we read these laws, especially in Leviticus, but also here in Exodus, when the worship of the tabernacle is set up, you begin to realize that huge amounts of Israel's national product went into what went on in the temple. Thousands upon thousands of animals were slain. The name of the historian, in Jesus' day,
Josephus.
Couldn't think of the name. Blank. Josephus. I've said this before. Josephus writes that on Passover, you could smell the blood in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, 7 miles to the south. There were so many animals that were killed, sacrificed. So redeem with a lamb every firstborn donkey, but if you do not redeem it, break its neck. It does not belong to you. It belongs to the Lord. You either buy it back or you kill it. Well, if you're not going to buy it back, then you're probably not going to kill it, but you're now disobeying the Lord. The Lord is making clear what his will is. Redeem every firstborn among your sons. Who is the most famous son to be redeemed with a sacrifice?
Jesus.
Yeah. So Mary and Joseph, on the day of her purification, 40 days after Jesus was born, brought the Savior to the Lord to present him to the Lord and to buy him back. And the law would make clear that if a lamb didn't work for you, and that could be, we always say because of poverty, but that may have to do with it. But for many, it would be very difficult to bring their own lamb. And then the purchase of a lamb would be expensive. So if you're traveling a long ways, it's not easy to bring your own lamb. In days to come, so as the history of Israel works itself out, when your son asks you, "What does this mean?" say to him, "With a mighty hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed every firstborn in Egypt, both man and animal. This is why I sacrifice to the Lord the first male offspring of every womb and redeem each of my firstborn sons." So that's the second time that Moses and the Lord have instructed the children to ask, "What does this mean?" It's the same thing is true of the meal. So in the Passover meal, after this, at some point, the youngest child in the family who was able to do it would be carefully prepared. I mean, you couldn't do it if you're 6 months old, but if you're four, you could. And when the right time came, he would be prodded and, you know, it's okay, now's your time. And he would say, "What does this mean? What does this meal mean?" And the head of the family. And when your children ask you why there's a sacrifice for the firstborn or why the firstborn belongs, explain why. "So that is why I sacrifice to the Lord the first male offspring of every womb and redeem each of my firstborn sons. And it will be like a sign on your hand and a symbol on your forehead that the Lord brought us out of Egypt with his mighty hand." So some Jews did that literally and wear the phylacteries. "When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country." And you understand that normally they would have just headed straight up along the sea. It's quite level there. And it would be an easy track. Well, but it would also mean that they'd have to deal with the Egyptian garrisons along the way that the Egyptians controlled. And in a warfare against Egypt, they'd have to battle Egypt on that relatively flat land next to the sea. They would be at a distinct disadvantage to the Egyptians. So, "He did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt." So his people really weren't seasoned and ready. "So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea." And the northern part, the Yom Suf, the Sea of Reeds. "The Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle." So they went up as an army, but they were somewhat ragtag and not that, well-trained and prepared. "Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. He had said, 'God will surely come to your aid.'" You know, he's going to come and rescue you. You're going to go back to the promised land. "And then you must carry my bones up with you from this place because I want to be buried in the land that God promised my people." After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. So they made it. They've escaped from Egypt because once they enter the desert, Egypt is not going to be able to do anything about them. Their power with their army will not be effective. They had a defensive army, or they had an army that could conquer other civilizations like Egypt. But they did not want to do battle with the Bedouins out in the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light. It's the glory of the Lord. In the daytime, it's shielded from them by a cloud. At night, it glows like fire. But it's the same, no doubt the same cloud, yes.
Now, when I was there, to me, it seemed God had to do that, or they would never be able to know where each other was, because that country is so rugged. If you've got millions of people there, I have never been in any place which is so incredibly desolate.
Oh, as the Sinai.
As the Sinai. You need to have a cloud in front. You know, you need to have that in order for everybody to know where everybody needs to be. He was indeed their guide.
Right. They didn't know where they were going.
Oh, true.
Even if some of them had known the Sinai, and they didn't because they lived in Goshen, they still didn't know where they were going. They
get lost. Yeah. You turn around, you go around a hill, and you're lost.
Yes, right, right. Well, it's interesting. Now, the land of Sinai has always been a difficult land, even back in those days, but it is far worse today. There is no pasture in this. There aren't anything more than small little flocks in certain valleys and so forth, because the whole Middle East is far drier today than it was in Jesus' day. The Middle East had more rain in biblical times than it has. In the centuries after Jesus' birth, and I'm trying to remember, I remember reading about this, but I think, I'm going to guess that by something like 800 or so, the climate had changed quite dramatically in the Middle East. And ever since that time, it has been very much drier than it was. So Israel would not be a land flowing with milk and honey today on the basis of the rainfall that it gets. So, all right. So the Lord leads them. This is, in Hebrew, the Shekinah, the glory. This is what, on the night of Jesus' birth, Jesus was born that day, and that night the angels came to the shepherds in the fields. And we're told that the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. I love the King James. And they were sore afraid. but I don't want to explain that to fifth graders either. So that's the glory of the Lord. And they were shielded from it, but it effectively led them. So good point, Marlis. Verse chapter 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea." They made it. They got away from the Egyptians, and now God says to them, "Turn around and go back to that north end of the Red Sea near the Delta and so forth, in all that flat land where the Sea of the Yam Suf is, and camp between Migdol and the sea. They are to encamp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon." And we think we can get that reasonably close, but whenever you're in an area like the Delta, it changes. I mean, the Mississippi Delta, for instance, changes all the time, and over a period of years, it really changes. All right. "The Israelites are..." And so here's what God tells Moses. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. They don't want to go out into the desert either. That's what Pharaoh is going to think. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart. So he might have good sense to think back to, I mean, if you've gotten thumped 10 times, you know, how much does it take you to learn, you know? But I'll harden his heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. So the Israelites did this. I don't know if there was grumbling yet. I wouldn't doubt it, but it's not spoken of. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, "What have we done? We have let the Israelites go and have lost their services." So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of his best chariots, along with all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers over all of them. Probably the 600, the best chariots, are his own force, the king's you know, units. And then there's the other armies, and they're going to clobber the Israelites. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites, who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi Hahiroth, opposite Baal Zephon. So Egypt had its chariots and horses. What are the chariots and horses of Israel? Not necessarily here. That phrase.
What?
Well, yes, but in the Bible, it talks about, if you know, hang on, let people think just a little bit. In another dramatic incident in the Bible, there is a reference to the horses and chariots of Israel. Mm-hmm. And who are they? They are a person.
Moses and Aaron?
Who are they, Andy? Well, or who is it, I mean?
Well, at the time of Elijah is when you see that.
When Elijah was taken up in the whirlwind, that's a lesson coming up in our worship services because of the ascension of the Lord. Elisha did not want to be separate from Elijah because he's worried about him disappearing. I mean, Elijah was the guy who called down fire from heaven, and Elisha wasn't sure he was really ready to go, but God sweeps up Elijah in a whirlwind, and Elijah cries out, "The horses and chariots of Israel," and he's talking about Elijah. Elijah, the prophet, and it wasn't Elijah as a human being, it was Elijah as the prophet of the Lord. That's the strength of Israel. Egypt's got its chariots and horses, so does Israel. But that's not directly related to here. All right. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. Well, you can see the dust rising, you know. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die?" You know, when you read the hieroglyphics on the temples in Egypt or in Babylon or anywhere, you just hear highfalutin language about kings trying to glorify themselves or their nations and so forth. But when you read the Bible, it's like if you were making a movie of this, that's exactly what you'd have the people say. You wouldn't have to change it a bit. Weren't there enough graves in Egypt? Brought us out here in the desert to die. The Egyptians are going to clobber us. What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? We always knew, Moses, you didn't know what you were doing. Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone? Let us serve the Egyptians. We're happy just to be slaves. And of course, Moses is saying, "Oh, the Lord is calling you. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. That's one of the greatest verses in the scripture for all of us. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. That's hard though, isn't it? As we are people who want to have the control of our lives in our own hands. And when, well, the Egyptian army is not likely to show up in whatever form in the 21st century. Might, who knows? There could be something terrible happen, but we can't see that on the horizon. What's the Egyptian army today? Well, it could be a depression where you lose everything. It could be the doctor saying you've got cancer. And the Lord says to the children of Israel, the Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? And of course, Moses is, I don't think this reflects the fact that Moses has lost faith, although maybe a little bit, I don't know. But Moses is the spokesman for the people, and the people are, you know, they're telling Moses, well, cry out to the Lord. So, but maybe he's a little nervous about the whole thing too. Tell the Israelites, the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Move on where? You know, tell them to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. And from now on, in the book of Psalms, in the song that Moses is going to sing, the chariots of and the horsemen of Egypt represent the forces of evil, and God protects his people. I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the angel of God. Now, this is not an angel of God, so once again we have that likelihood, I guess is the way I would say it, that this is the Son of God pre-incarnate, before he becomes born a child, a human being. But however you interpret it, the angel of God, who had been traveling in front of Israel's army, withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to the one side and light to the other side, so that neither went near the other all night long. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. Now, what happens is you get two different pictures, and I think we need to be careful not to be too influenced by Cecil B. DeMille. I would think of Charlton Heston. You remember the movie The Ten Commandments, and if you go down to, what is it, Paramount? What? No, that's not right. One of the studios, you can, they've got a ride where the water is part similarly in the way, I haven't been there, but to the way they did in the movie. It's based on the movie, The Ten Commandments. So in all the movies, we have this picture of these walls of water with, even in some of the animated versions, you know, there are dolphins swimming in the water next to the people and things like that. Well, the scripture does refer to the children of Israel being surrounded by a wall of water. Now, perhaps that is literally true. But much of the language, there's two kinds of language. Much of the language is that the water is blown and then comes roaring back. The children of Israel are poets at heart. And so the idea of the walls of water can be an expression of God using the water to protect the children rather than a literal description of exactly how he did it. It doesn't make it any less of a miracle because he didn't do it the way Cecil B. DeMille pictured it. It's a miracle. There's no doubt about that. So the wind blows and it, let's read it exactly there. All that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. So clearly it can be exactly that. That what the wind did is it drove like a trough through. It's possible. The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. During the last watch of the night, the night didn't have watches. So a watch is when you post soldiers, they would be up for 3 or 4 hours, and the night would be broken into watches. So as the night gets to the end, during the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. He made the wheels of the chariots come off. Now, that's how the NIV has translated it. It's possible. If you look at the note, it can be that the wheels wouldn't turn, rather than that they came off. The Hebrew word is not clear. In any case, they're having problems. So that they had difficulty driving. Well, of course, if your wheels fall off, you're going to have difficulty driving. That's why I would favor the other version, that the wheels wouldn't turn. But it's the language is not clear. It can be translated either way. And the Egyptians said, these are the GIs, the soldiers in the Egyptian army, they said, let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt, and we've seen that before, and it does not turn out well. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen. So again, some people have said to me, oh, it sounds like you're doubting whether the Lord can do this miracle. I'm not doubting the miracle at all. But, you know, if there were 1.6 million people that crossed the sea in that night, the estimate is that the opening in the sea needed to be at least a half mile across to simply get that number of people across. And so the idea of this narrow, you know, picture that we have from the movies is not accurate. Now, exactly how it worked, the meaning difference, the Lord saved them. But then what happened? Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. That day, the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. So when it was all over, the bodies were floating up. And when the Israelites saw the great power of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. And that was good for a couple of months anyway, maybe. So they were just like us. Now, The children of Israel were renowned in the ancient world as poets and musicians. We don't always realize that because the Bible does, but they sing a song at the drop of a hat. And Christians have been doing that ever since. Music is clearly close to the heart of the Lord. In Revelation, the word, they cried out with a loud voice in the visions of heaven. That's singing, not shouting. Here's the song of Moses and one by his sister, Miriam. Remember, Miriam is the one who watched over him when he was a child, his older sister. Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. Now we presume that it's Moses' song. I guess it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be. It could be whatever. Does everybody have 15 to 21?
No.
Oh, they didn't get around.
No.
Okay. Keep on going. There's some too. Whoa. Okay. All right.
I know only one.
Yeah, just one. All right. And what is this song? Now, it could have been written by anybody. It doesn't make any difference. Moses sings it, but we've always thought of it as the song of Moses. And that's, I think that's likely. Moses sings this song. I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea. Horses were not the compliant animals that they are today. They were much more ferocious. Donkeys are beasts of burdens, mules. Horses, was very hard to break them. So the horse and its rider is hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. The Lord has surrounded me with songs of deliverance. The Psalms pick up this line in a couple of places. The Lord is my strength and my song. So the strength of Israel isn't in a spear, it's in a song. He has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, because he made the promise to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob, to Israel, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. I am who I am. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has hurled into the sea. The best of Pharaoh's officers are drowned in the Red Sea. This is a wonderful song. In Hebrew, those who really know Hebrew and, you know, can get the feel for the language say that this is one of the finest of the Psalms of the entire Old Testament. It is a literary gem. You can see the pictures. The deep waters have covered them. They sank to the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, was majestic in power. Your right hand, O Lord, shattered the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you threw down those who opposed you. You unleashed your burning anger. It consumed them like stubble. What's stubble? Yes, it's the dry stalks of the crops that are cut off. Well, when that catches fire, it just zoom, you know, like up north of us here. They used to, well, they still do some degree. What do?
Burn
the rice fields, right? There's less of that than there was. All right. It consumed them like stubble. By the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The surging waters stood firm like a wall. The deep waters congealed in the heart of the sea. The water turned solid. The enemy boasted, I will pursue. I will overtake them. I will divide the spoils. I will gorge myself on them like a predatory animal. I will draw my sword and my hand will destroy them. But you blew with your breath and the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders? You stretched out your right hand and the earth swallowed them. These are dramatic words, wonderful poetry. So, our God is an awesome, there's a song like that. Our God is an awesome God, but it's a ditty. Unfortunately, one of the lines is, he ain't putting on the Ritz. Doesn't quite match up to Moses' language here. So awesome in glory, working wonders, you stretched out your right hand and the earth swallowed them. In your unfailing love, you will lead the people you have redeemed. In your strength, you will guide them to your holy dwelling. The nations will hear and tremble. Anguish will grip the people of Philistia. So what is God's holy dwelling? See, you could think of it perhaps as Sinai, but it isn't because why? Because who's in anguish? The people of Philistia, and they are next door to Israel. So the homeland of the Lord, and ultimately he's going to dwell in the temple in Jerusalem, but that lies in the future. The land of Israel is his holy dwelling. The nations will hear and tremble. Anguish will grip the people of Philistia. The chiefs of Edom, that's to the south and east, will be terrified. The leaders of Moab will be seized with trembling. That's more directly to the east. The people of Canaan will melt away. Terror and dread will fall upon them. By the power of your arm, they will be as still as a stone until your people pass by, O Lord, until the people you bought pass by. You will bring them in and plant them on the mountain of your inheritance, the place, O Lord, you made for your dwelling. And because that sounds so much like what? On the mountain of your inheritance, the place you made for your dwelling. It sounds like Jerusalem. And so liberal scholars say, Moses didn't write this. You know, somebody wrote it much later on and attributed it to Moses. Okay, well, you know, do your own thing, whatever it is. The place you made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, your hands established. The Lord will reign forever and ever. And as we hear this song, we need to see the greater fulfillment and the greater kingdom and the greater victory that is coming. When Jesus returns and we're raised from the dead, the world in all of its power is going to be wiped away. And there will be a new heaven and a new earth, a new creation. When Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and horsemen went into the sea, the Lord brought the waters of the sea back over them. But the Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground. Then Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women followed her with tambourines and dancing. Miriam sang to them, "Sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea." So Miriam picks up, it's like a refrain from the song of Moses, and the women are rejoicing and everybody is excited, and unfortunately they got tired and went to bed and forgot all about it. The waters of Marah and Elim. So after the victory, we continue. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. Well, 3 days, it's getting desperate. And remember, we're talking in excess of 1 million people. I mean, there's no water there at all now. There wasn't enough water there. But they Moses marches off and they're singing their songs and they head off. Well, it isn't long and they're pretty parched. When they came to Marah, Marah is a word that means bitter. They could not drink its water because it was bitter. That is why the place is called Marah. So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink? And when you let us out in the desert, what are we supposed to do?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. Then there the Lord made a decree and a law for them, and there he tested them. He said, "If you listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians. For I am the Lord who heals you." So they come to the first test. You know, there's no water, or the water that they do find is bitter. And so then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs and 70 palm trees. And they camped there near the water. So as they're traveling, they went through a difficult time, the wilderness of Shur, and God provided water, and now they, where there are a number of springs, and it's an oasis.
Do you have an attendance sheet?
Is it? It's right there. Why don't you take it out? Yeah. All right, chapter 16, manna and quail. And we kind of jump ahead here. Later on, there's a better explanation of why the Lord provided quail. So let's just follow along. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin. That has no relation to the English word. It's not an English word. Which is between Elim and Sinai. So they're on their way to Mount Horeb, to Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month, after they had come out of Egypt. So they're 6 weeks away from Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve the entire assembly to death." Well, they've got water, but now they're getting hungry. Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven." Now remember that after the feeding of the 5,000, John records that quite lengthy, do we call it a sermon? I wouldn't call it a sermon, but what he says to those who don't trust in him about being, "I am the bread of life, and you must eat my flesh and drink my blood," and so forth. That comes when Jesus provides food for 5,000, which is not nearly, his enemies said, what Moses did in the desert. Well, it wasn't Moses that did it. Was the Lord, but that's what they say. That's John chapter 6. "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day." It's going to fall down from heaven. "In this way I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day, they are to prepare what they bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gather on the other days, because no one works on the Sabbath." You'll see what happens. "So Moses and Aaron said to the Israelites, 'In the evening you will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that you should grumble against us?'" Don't kid yourself, folks. You're complaining against us, but you're really complaining against the Lord. Moses also said, you will know that it was the Lord when he gives you meat to eat in the evening and all the bread you want in the morning, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we? You are not grumbling against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses told Aaron, say to the entire Israelite community, come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. So there's a gathering of the people. While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked toward the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. So you perhaps get the impression, kind of difficult to say, but that maybe the cloud was not always there in this six-week period of time, and now they see it again. But not necessarily. And at any rate, they see it in the desert. The Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. That evening quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, what is it? Well, in Hebrew, that is manna. What is it? And so they called it, what is it? For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, it is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Each one of you is to gather as much as he needs. Take an omer for each person, that's a measurement, you have in your tent. So you can go out and gather that much for each person that you have in your tent. The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. Well, was that right? Sure, because some had a lot of people in the tent, some people didn't. So some gathered a lot, some gathered little. And when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. Each one gathered as much as he needed. Then Moses said to them, no one is to keep any of it until morning. Well, why would they want to do that?
For six weeks,
they have been very short of food. Now I'm going to pour out the food, so, well, I'm going to, you'll have to peel my cold, dead fingers off of it, you know. And God says, no. Okay. Then Moses, no one is to keep any of it until morning. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it till the morning, but it was full of maggots and it began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Each morning, everyone gathered as much as he needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person, and the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said to them, this is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left and keep it until morning. So he had said that, but apparently the leaders were worried that the Lord was going to be angry. It's hard to tell exactly what was happening. So they saved it until morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. Eat it today, Moses said, because today is a Sabbath to the Lord. So it's a time of rest. So you don't have to go out and gather. You did it the day before. You will not find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you are to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any. You are to rest. Well, here comes now the Sabbath law. This is the first time in the scripture that the Sabbath is mentioned. It's going to be encoded into the covenant that God gives with his people and confirms at Mount Sinai. We've got some Christian brothers and sisters today, however, who think what?
Seventh-day Adventist.
Yeah, that the Sabbath is to be honored. What is their principal argument? That it should be honored, even though the other provisions of the Mosaic Covenant that were fulfilled, like the sacrifices, aren't honored. We don't do sacrifices. why doesn't, in their view, the Sabbath day pass away? Because when God created the world, he rested on the seventh day. And therefore, it's good for all time in their reasoning. Well, the Sabbath law was a very important provision of God's covenant with his people. If anyone worked on the Sabbath day, what was the punishment? Well, in some places, death by stoning, in others, exile. If a command so important as this, in the view of Seventh-day Adventists, went entirely through the life of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Noah, Terah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all the children of Israel until now, without a single mention. And why isn't it mentioned? Because they didn't observe the Sabbath. But the argument for the Sabbath to the children of Israel was, when Moses wrote Genesis, that God rested on the seventh day. But there was no Sabbath before that. And then you have Paul writing, in his letter to the Colossian Christians, let no man judge you with regard to Sabbath days. Don't anybody tell you you're right or wrong, or don't let, if you want to count one day as more important than the other, fine, you can do that. Some people do it, some people don't. And in any case, it doesn't make any difference. All right. So they were to rest on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. No one is to go out. We've got enough bread for 2 days. The people of Israel called the bread manna. What is it? It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. So it was very sweet. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come, so they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the desert when I brought you out of Egypt." And what was... what did they do with that omer of manna?
They put it in the Ark of the Covenant.
They put it in the Ark of the Covenant in a gold container, right?
Question.
Yes.
I
know the answer.
Thought I read this carefully, in that the quail came, but I couldn't come to the conclusion whether they continued to come or did not.
Well, okay, I was letting that kind of float for a while. In the book of Numbers, we find out that God sent quail. Why?
Well, they were complaining they had no meat.
Yeah, they were tired of this food, this manna.
Yeah.
Well, but see, it sounds like that they had quail from the very beginning. But this is something you have to understand about Hebrew, the Hebrew scriptures in the Old Testament. For them, what is the most important thing is what is said, not necessarily the order in which things come. So here Moses is telling what happened, and what happened was that God provided manna for them in the morning and quail in the evening. But later on we find out that actually the way the Lord did it, and I think this is the best explanation, and people have offered other ones, but actually the way it happened was he provided them manna, but then they complained and they were tired of it, so then he provided quail to come up. And to Moses is just telling us what happened overall. The details of exactly how it occurred. Now that drives us nuts, because if you're going to tell us, then tell us the first time and tell us in the right order. But So there are other explanations. When we get to Numbers, we'll talk about that a little bit. But most of them are pretty reaching. And I think the best explanation I've read is that Moses here is just telling us what occurred. He's saying what happened when the children of Israel were out there. He isn't, and all of his readers would know exactly how it happened. You know, that they grumbled later on and then the Lord gave them. I don't know. Does that get at what you're thinking about?
Well, I read another article that said that the quail was a migratory bird. Mm-hmm. And if the location in which they were, they would have been very tired when they landed into the camp, which would have been a one-time phenomenon, which makes sense to me.
Yeah, but it wasn't a one-time phenomenon.
Well, but that's why I was reading this, and I could not find beyond the one time in this section.
Oh, yeah. But when you get to Numbers, it's okay, spelled out. Numbers. Yeah, right. I think it's Numbers. I'm okay. Somebody's going to say, where is it? And I'd have to look. I can't remember. But I think it's Numbers. Because, Leviticus doesn't tell us much of the story of what happened, and neither does Deuteronomy. That's the end. So it's Numbers, you know. But where? I think those two go together, Andy. Look at the plagues in Egypt, how they were apparently things that occurred with some, you know, normalcy, but when the Lord, then they were completely out of control. Well, here in a positive way, something that may have begun in a certain way kept on going, and you wouldn't expect it to keep on going, you know. So, but I think that we're often trying to explain away miracles. And that's why I'm a little nervous. When I was talking about the walls of water and so forth, I'm not trying to explain away the miracles. I just don't want us to think of this like a cartoon movie, The Prince of Egypt, or something like that. You have to let the words speak for themselves. So the Lord pushed this water back. But, you know, we don't have a narrow pathway through. See, there's nothing in the text to say that. So we're not trying to explain away the miracles, but rather just let the words speak for themselves and not let a picture from the 20th century determine how we think it happened. Let the words do that.
It's in Numbers 11, verse 18.
Oh, okay. What does it say?
Tell the people, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow when you will eat meat. The Lord heard you when you wailed. If only we had meat to eat, we were better off in Egypt. Now the Lord will give you meat and you will eat it. You will not eat it for just one day or 2 days or 5, 10, or 20 days, but for the whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wailed before him saying, why did we ever leave Egypt?
So the possibility of what they were seeing, Andy, is that it did occur. I think that's one way to look at it. That it did occur here one time and then it occurred again. But at any rate, Moses is giving us the whole story. You know, and the Lord fed them with manna and quail. Okay. Let's see. Wait a minute now. Oh, okay, it says in Omer, wait a minute, all right. Oh, all right, verse 33. So Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an Omer of manna in it, then place it before the Lord to be kept for the generations to come. Well, before the Lord is in the Ark of the Covenant. You know, what does it mean the Ark of the Covenant hasn't been made yet? But that's where it ends up. As the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna in front of the testimony. See? So this is kind of irritating. The testimony is in the Ark of the Covenant. And it hasn't been built yet, and that drives us nuts. But I think Moses would say, well, that's where it ended up. Yeah, we got to tell you the story of how the Ark of the Covenant was built, but don't get so excited about it. That's where it ended up. The Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. So maybe look a little bit more. My impression from growing up was that they ate quail all the time. But you know what? I don't know that that's accurate, huh? I think the quail were occasional, at least. Certainly you're going to, for 30 days.
But they ate
manna
for 40 years.
Yeah, oh yeah, they ate manna for 40 years. But no doubt about that, yeah. But did they eat quail? Maybe not, you know.
I'm reading all that.
Manna in the morning, quail in the evening. I mean, you learn that in Sunday school. Okay. Well, we'll be looking at the rest that it has to say. So now let's go for one of the incidents that sets Moses up for his great fall. It took Moses, what, 1,400 years to make it to the Promised Land. Because of what begins, not what happens right here, but what begins here. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses, as all the problems come to Moses. Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" See what Moses is saying? I talk, it's God talking. "But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses." There's a lot of people there. And they're having to ration the water very carefully, and they got flocks. They grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" See, we could have just stayed in Egypt. You know, that is not one whit different than us. If the Lord asks us to sacrifice, then we in our hearts say, "Why can't I just be like everybody else?" And it's dedicating all this stuff to the Lord and sacrificing and so forth. We just as soon stay in Egypt. Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Walk on ahead of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel so that they can be witnesses. And take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile." Now presumably that's the same staff that he held out over the Sea of Reeds, the Yom Suf. But at any rate, "The staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb." So I presume that the Shekinah, the pillar of cloud, goes ahead. By the rock at Horeb. It's this Mount Horeb. That's a big... it's not clear there. Because are they already there? Is this an incident that took place later? Well, we don't need to worry about it. It happened. "I will stand there by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink." And I say this is the setup for Moses' fall later on. Because God just tells him to speak later on, and the water will come out. But Moses uses his staff, you know, so people can see that he was really doing it. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah and Meribah. Look at the Massah means testing, and Meribah means quarreling. So they did all this complaining, but God was testing them. Because the Israelites quarreled, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not? We're going to die of thirst. Is the Lord watching over us?" The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. So now this is another story. This is the first time that the Israelites fight, as far as we know. And we presume that it is. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. So let's organize here. They're threatening us. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with my staff of, with the staff of God in my hands. So this is Joshua now. Now Joshua, remember, that's Jesus' name. Yeshua. Yeshua. That's what his mother called in Aramaic, going back to Hebrew. In Greek, the Greeks hate words that end in ah. It sounds to them like the talk of barbarians. So in Greek, they stick an end, an S at the end. So Yeshua becomes Jesus, which in English is Jesus. So the name Joshua and Jesus are the same name. They just come from two different languages, like John and Johann, or Jean in French. What I can't think suddenly in what is Juan in Spanish? Yeah, there's John everywhere where there's any influence of the Bible. Okay. Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands, holding up the prophet's hands, up one on one side and one on the other, so that his hands remained steady until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Now, why is that there? Why is this story there? Why did the Lord do it this way? And that's why the story is there, because that's why the Lord did it that way. What is he doing? What is the Lord doing? He could defeat the Amalekites in 15 ways from Sunday. Okay, why does he do it this way? What does it do?
But doesn't it lets the people know that they're not doing it on their own. They're doing it. The Lord's doing it for them.
And the Lord is doing it through
Moses.
But
Moses,
right.
Isn't doing it.
Moses, but the Lord is doing it. Moses is the one. Remember, they're always grumbling against Moses.
Yeah.
And Moses thinks they're going to stone him. So God is giving Moses some strength for Moses and testimony to the children of Israel. All right, so that's a wonderful story. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Don't attack God's people. So God says to Moses, write this down and let Joshua know later on, because later on the Amalekites are going to be wiped out. Moses built an altar and called it, the Lord is my banner. You raise the banner on high. He said, for hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. That's a good point to stop. All right, and we're going to see Jethro. That's a biblical name, but has kind of fallen out of favor. Has anyone here ever known someone named Jethro? Besides Beverly Hillbillies, yeah. Yeah. Jethro was a name that was popular among pious people in the Appalachians. People. Where does anyone know where the people in the Appalachians originally came from? The Appalachian people. They were Scotch-Irish.
Right.
People, but especially from Scotland, who came, and because they liked the Highlands. and they settled in the Appalachians. So that's kind of interesting. Why did I think of that? I can't even think of why I thought of that.
Jethro.
Oh, Jethro, yeah, thank you. Hillbillies, you know, the name Jethro, yeah. It's a biblical name, thank you. I knew there was a reason. I'm completely off the beam here. All right. Okay.